From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt. Our colleague Noel is off on an adventure that I'm sure you'll hear about soon.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This is a bit of a grab bag episode. Let's see, Matt, are we hearing this in 2021? Are you and I recording in 2020 for an episode that comes out next year?
Gee, let me think. Yes. Yes, this comes out. This is an early episode in 2021.
Well, congratulations, everyone listening to this. You've made it. What strange horizons await?
Yeah, you made it past that arbitrary line in the sand that we drew between years.
I think about that all the time, the way that calendars evolved. You know, historically, like, there have always been New Year's celebrations, but in many ancient civilizations, the New Year was something closer to what we in the modern day would call March. And there was this, just this intense cartoonish series of events that led to January 1st becoming the day. So shout out to I can't remember which pope it was, but shout out to them.
Old Gregory.
The 13th?
I'm just kidding. No, the Gregorian calendar is what I'm referring to, but it is not a man named Gregory. It is cartoonish that we wouldn't start the new year in the spring when life begins again. Why not? why did we? No? Okay. In the middle of winter. Okay, cool. Let's do that. Let's do that. At least, again, that's my North American centric mind when I'm talking about seasons.
Well, you and I have talked off air before about how arbitrary the current calendar is. And we've also talked before, I can't remember whether this made it on air, but we had some pretty great conversations about different calendars around the world. You know, it is literally a different year and a different era in various regions, various countries across this planet. We are still going to celebrate, though. Who does? You know what? I think at this point, everybody is thankful for a win. So let's all moderately congratulate ourselves and let's stick together for 2021.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're not going to celebrate. If you live anywhere near a major city, you will hear the new year rung in by the sound of your dog whimpering somewhere in your house.
Right.
Because all the boom booms. Ben, before we jump in.
Yes.
I've been listening to a lot of voicemails lately, and a lot of people reached out to us in early December, late November, asking about a particular book that we mentioned on an episode past about behavioral, not manipulation, weaponized psychology. do you remember at all the title of that book that we were referring to?
I couldn't
recall it.
I do. I was looking at it earlier this weekend, in fact. And I hate to be the party pooper here, but I will not recommend that book on air, nor will I propagate its title. I will propose an alternative book that can give you a lot of the same information or a good primer, a good intro. It's called You Say More Than You Think. This is a book by Janine Driver, and it studies, well, it's somewhat of an applied approach to using body language in a mindful way to accomplish certain desires, goals, and so on. The book, You Say More Than You Think, it centers around a 7-day plan for inculcating yourself with new habits, body language-wise, and then sticking with them, maintaining them, and growing them. For instance, if you are listening to today's podcast and you are sitting down, do us a favor. Do yourself a favor. Don't move. Don't move your body. But think of your feet. Be aware of your feet. Where are they? Are they splayed out? Are they crossed, maybe slightly beneath your chair? Which foot is the closest to the back of the chair? Or if they're not crossed, which direction are your feet pointing in? And what's in that direction? Things like that. They're very small things. They're things that we don't often notice consciously unless we are trained to do so. Such as, you know, like if you are an FBI agent or you're someone who conducts various types of interviews or interrogations, or you're perhaps a trial lawyer, right? So that's the book I would recommend in lieu of this. Again, I'm sorry to be a party pooper, but just I think "You Say More Than You Think" is a great and a more wholesome way to get involved with the analysis of body language. But do keep in mind, segue, that many wholesome things have disturbing origins. And that's what today's show is about. It's often said that a great crime is at the origin of every great fortune. And to a degree, this cliche rings true. So in this episode today, toward the very end of a very arbitrary calendar, we are diving into skeletons of some beloved or at least accepted and lauded institutions to uncover their strange, often troubled, very disturbing beginnings. Spoiler alert, conspiracy realists, this does get crazy very, very quickly. Matt, how would you? What would you say on a 1 to 9? Where are we at with that segue?
Let's see, 1 to 9. Hold on, let me check my. Okay, my legs are crisscross applesauce. I'm looking at my screen. I would say that was a pretty good segue there, Ben. Let's give it a 7.
A 7.
Yeah.
Too kind.
Wait, is the 7 good or? Okay, yeah, sure. All right, so so let's segue even harder here into something that I know nothing about outside of the experience of the people around me. Gynecology. It's not even something that I really have any right to talk about. But I'm just going to tell you, and you probably already know this, hopefully, that the origins of gynecology are pretty horrific.
Here are the facts.
And the first thing you need to know, if you don't already, is that the origins of gynecology begin with slavery. Yes. there is a man who is considered to be the father of gynecology. He is hailed in this way. And his name is James Marion Sims. There are statues erected in this man's honor. And, you know, in overall concept, at least in the modern day, gynecology is a tremendously helpful and fantastic thing. Overall, it, you know, enhances the health of women across the globe. However, this man, James, he practiced medicine when treating women was considered perhaps distasteful, which is a terrible thing to even think, but it was also rarely done. He invented something called the vaginal speculum, which is a tool used for examination, a very helpful tool.
Yes, Sims also pioneered surgical techniques. One technique was to repair what's known as a vesicovaginal fistula. This was a common complication of childbirth in the 19th century. It's when a tear occurs between the uterus and the bladder, and it causes constant pain. It causes problems with urination. It is overall a good thing in the world that techniques exist to address this issue. But while Sims was doing this, he was conducting, as you said, Matt, he was conducting all of his experimentation. That's really what it was. It was human experimentation. He was conducting it on enslaved women. And some of these people went on to be his assistant. And doubtlessly, even in this horrific, unclean origin, I would say it is doubtless that his assistants probably pioneered some of the techniques that are credited to him today. Because, as you said at the top of this discussion, we're dudes. So we're dudes. We're not OBGYNs. So we know this from an outsider or an intellectual rather than experiential perspective. It's incredibly misleading to characterize his experiments, these acts of cruelty, as research. This experimentation was done without anesthesia, and he didn't like the idea of informed consent or the idea of therapeutic treatment is not something that occurs to Sims. He caused untold suffering of a great magnitude by operating under a racist notion that still persists in Western medicine today. The idea that someone based on their skin color may have a different experience with pain. Sims seemed to believe that Black people did not feel pain, which is ridiculous. And you have to look at the studies of modern medicine, right? In Western Europe as well as in the United States, you will see medical professionals who do not believe their patients when they're saying, "I have this condition. I am in tremendous pain." It echoes today. There is a terrible ripple effect.
I want to add to that. My wife is Cuban. And mm-hmm. very recently, she has gone to the doctor on numerous occasions requesting assistance in the form of either medication or further, you know, studies on her just to see what is wrong. And she has been met with essentially, take some Tylenol, you'll be fine. Or you just need more sleep, take some melatonin, you'll be fine. Like just hearing it from her and knowing what she's going through and how she's feeling, it's baffling to me that is the way she is being treated. And it took several attempts, basically, for her to actually get help from a medical professional. And it's just very, very disturbing that it continues.
Yeah. You know, the worst part, Matt, is this is going to be familiar to a lot of our fellow listeners today. Right. Listening to this, you may have experienced this firsthand. And I've always had a problem with the stereotype when they say, oh, you know, certain people don't trust doctors, because I think that's an incorrect way to frame it. The more accurate way to frame that idea is that doctors don't trust certain people. Statistically, and this is not a ding on the excellent medical professionals we have listening to the show today. This is based on some fairly robust studies over time. Maybe it's an episode in the future, but we wanted to use gynecology as just one example of something that has saved lives. Undeniably saved millions of lives, but has its origins in a terrible, unforgivable thing. And this is only the beginning, right? We know German and U.S. companies helped the Nazis during World War II, for example. And you can read these corporations' various public statements about this, which we've talked about in the past. And they're all something along the lines of, we didn't know. It was a different time. It was a subsidiary we acquired later, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But save it. Miss me with that. Gynecology is one of the most well-known examples of a horrifying origin story, but it is by no means the only story of this kind. Many, many great institutions that do good things for the world around us have at their heart great crimes in their origin, and they remain active and they remain profitable in the modern day. What are we talking about? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy.
Well, let's start with something we can all agree on, shall we? Yes? The environment. You know, the air we breathe, the water we drink.
Oh, yeah.
The flora and fauna, all the things that make up le environment. Well, it's a good thing, I think, right? It's a good thing to have around.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. Yeah. And it seems as though we humans, the ones with the capacity to fully alter our surroundings and the environment, we should probably take care of it as best we can, right? The world is our responsibility in no small part. And, you know, we owe it to future generations. You owe it to my son. So listen up. I'm just joking. I owe it to your daughter and your son, too. We all owe it to each other to take care of it as best that we can. And there are many, countless groups out there, organizations, NGOs, small companies that have this as their aim. How do we best take care of the environment? And one of those groups is known as the Sierra Club. You may have heard of it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so weird that caring about the world around you somehow became a topic that was up for debate. It's true that that nefarious things have been conducted under the banner of environmentalism, but actually caring about the environment should not, there's not a political thing about it. We need the world more than the world needs us. If every human being on the planet, we're like, what, 20-something minutes into this podcast, if every human being on the planet vanished 25 minutes into this show, the rest of the world would be fine. You know what I mean? We're really just like, we should just clean up after ourselves. If a microcosmic example is helpful here, and don't worry about the politicization of all this stuff. Think about the last time you had a roommate who didn't clean up after they, you know, were in the restroom or in the kitchen. Screw them, right?
That's fisticuffs all day. Fisticuffs about the dishes. Come on.
And we looked into several of these groups numerous times in the past, and we found various noble things. We found various unethical things because people are still people, right, for the most part. We learned some weird stuff about the Sierra Club. As you said, Matt, it's one of the best known environmental groups in the United States. It's very old. It's a storied institution. It was founded back in 1892. And today it has around 2 million members. It has this innocent, ambitious motto that people of all creeds, nations, socioeconomic status, etc., can get behind. It's simply this, and I love it: explore, enjoy, and protect the planet. That's cool.
Yes! Captain Planet Unite!
Yeah,
heart.
We need the rings. I hate jewelry, but I would wear a ring for Captain Planet.
Sure, absolutely. That sounds amazing. Yes. Like you said, we can all get behind that. But there's some issues, like we said, with its origins. Now, when we're talking about these groups, generally, we don't mean every member, right? We certainly don't mean every member of the Sierra Club when we're talking about this. We're talking about the foundations. So very key players who are involved in any of these organizations, those are the folks we're focusing on. So here's the issue with the Sierra Club. A couple of key members of this thing were known racists, is the best way to put it, I suppose.
Right.
And, you know, when they were talking about saving the world, they aren't necessarily talking about saving it for everyone. They were talking about saving it for a very specific group of people, generally the more pasty ones, the white ones.
Which you can say.
I can say as, you know, as the, yeah, yeah.
You're right. One of the best phrases would be like virulent, avowed racist.
Oh, okay. Like, I thought you were going to say virulent Lee White or something. Okay, cool.
Maybe that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being who you are, and you can't change the circumstances of your birth or your DNA yet. But
I say that to myself in the mirror every morning. Continue.
but some of these key members, some of these founders, were hyper racist, like beyond prejudice. You know, like racist to the point where other people would say, well, I agree with racism, but we could talk about other stuff. Like, what do you think of oatmeal? And they're like, no, we're sticking with the racist thing. So,
jeez, yeah.
I know, that's unfair, but it's somewhat true. So the Sierra Club's founder, one John Muir, often talked in explicit documented terms about non-white people, words that, frankly, we decided we're not going to give space to on air. In 1901, he said that white people shouldn't be afraid to visit national parks because we're going to have to paraphrase here, the native population are going to be mostly dead or civilized into useless innocence.
Wow. We're choosing not to say these words. Right. I do want to point out one of the phrases that he used, or terms that he used, was up until very recently the name of a extremely large restaurant chain that you can look up if you're interested, which has since changed its name, by the way.
And of course, this we see a similar pattern in the world of sports, right? Major league teams are changing or will change their names. So this line of thinking from Muir, is it unfair to hold the current leaders of the Sierra Club responsible for things that happened before they were born that they could not in any way control? No, it's not fair in that regard. You know, you have to acknowledge that and be transparent about the institution. But the thing is, this line of thinking didn't stop with John Muir. It appeared to carry on into recent years. As recently as 1988, John Tanton, who was formerly the National Population Committee chairman of the Sierra Club, asked, and this is on record, quote, "What will happen when the white population goes into minority status and the groups that comprise the new coalition majorities don't share the same environmental values?" That's rough.
Just wonder where he even gets that thinking. I wonder where it comes from.
It's very us versus them, which seems strange because of the enormous amount of cooperation inherent in saving, preserving, or repairing the environment. These conservational values were often tied up, and I know we're dunking on the Sierra Club here, which it's an organization that does good work. That's the weird thing about this episode. All the organizations we're talking about, they do good stuff. But the environmentalist conservational values were often tied up in prejudicial, discriminatory beliefs that would be astounding in the modern day. And there were there's environmentalism, right? Make national parks, try to preserve wildlife and ecosystems. But another solution that was very popular was this idea of limiting the quote unquote wrong kind of immigration.
Yeah, the wrong kind of immigration. Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. Back in the 1960s, there was a popular theory amongst the Sierra Club that immigration, to a large extent, drives unsustainable population growth. So in one area, more humans in equals too many humans. I mean, that, to a rational mind, maybe, okay, well, that does make sense. You're adding to the population. There's population growth. Sure. The unsustainable part is a bit arguable, depending on the place. But you can see where the logic existed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The problem is that the perspective shifted to a hard line against immigration pretty much at all in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And again, like, it means they're more insular, right? They are taking a very hard stance on population growth, right? In general, we're going to be talking a lot about population growth in this episode. But luckily, as you know, the Sierra Club continued to mature after, you know, 112 years or something since John Muir was in there. They did seem to very much right the course here.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. In 2013, the Sierra Club announced its support for some immigration policies. It was a unanimous decision amid the group's board of directors, and it does mark a definitive break with their troubled, complicated history on immigration. However, not everyone took it well. One response from a Sierra Club member said the following, quote, "This divisive present stance has no place in the purpose of the club. To state that those voluntarily violating our laws should be rewarded with citizenship because they voluntarily came to our polluted country and must be protected as such is illogical in the scheme of environmentalism in the United States. The club has lost my support." So in there we see, in just that snapshot, in that response, we see the perspective of someone who prioritizes protecting the environment, does not want more people around, right? To your earlier statement about just the sheer math of it, right?
But ultimately they're taking issue with the illegal way in which a person entered this exactly. country, right? That's what they're saying.
Exactly. They're not. It's kind of like how Oregon was founded as a white supremacist utopia, which is true. I hate to say it, but it's true. The thing is, the logic is not consistent across this kind of viewpoint. It's not keep everybody out. It's keep some people out. Another response is even more explicit.
Yeah, here's another quote. "Like most environmental groups, the Sierra Club continues to ignore all the problems stemming from overpopulation in the United States and many other countries. This is nothing more than a call for amnesty for millions of welfare-dependent, overbreeding illegal aliens who can't speak English and don't know what condoms are. Jesus."
Wow. Tell us how you really feel, you know?
Let me level set here. Are these prominent members, or is this like a YouTube comment section?
Kind of like a YouTube comment section.
Okay.
I'll be honest. I picked the hot takes.
Okay. So we just need to point out there, this does not mean that these statements represent the Sierra Club. It
not
means
at all.
That certain supporters of the Sierra Club feel this way.
Picture Smokey the Bear. Everybody from the U.S. knows Smokey, I think. Everybody not in the U.S., we have a mascot that is dedicated to, like, convincing people not to set the forest on fire. That's his whole job. So picture this guy. He's great. His name's Smokey the Bear. I think in the U.K. it's a frog or something. But picture Smokey the Bear in the distance just shaking his head in slow, painful disapproval.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like just to continue here, the comments of a member, someone who pays member status, mm-hmm. rather than a founder or, you know, a board member or something like that, it's very different. It's a very different thing, and it doesn't hold as much weight. But it is troubling still to read that. Though I think you could probably find the organization to treat people nicely and not murder anyone would also have comments similar to this.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, I've got a great comparison here. Well, I've got let's see what you think. Tell me whether this comparison is on the level. I was thinking about any large organization of people, right? The leaders and the civilians or the members or the constituents or whatever you want to call them. I think one of the best examples of this would be senators or congresspeople, because some person may vote for a senator, right, or a congressperson, and then they may have views that this member of Congress completely disagrees with. You know what I mean? They're like, I voted for you because I like your policy on snowplows. Also, I think you should consider eugenics. And the senator is like, well, thanks for voting for me, I guess.
Nah, we're good. Have a good one. The snowplow is on the way.
The snowplow is on the way. So now we've got one example from the world of medicine. We've got another example from the world of nonprofits, right? And again, in both of these examples, there are genuinely good things, like objectively good things. Let's make it safer to be alive. That's what both of those things ultimately equate to, right? But let's shift a little. Or as they say in corporate America, let's pivot to the world of academia.
We're going to find some more synergies here.
Yes. It's our wheelhouse. Oh, gosh. We probably mentioned it before, but for years, Matt and I have been like compiling and collecting these various corporate terms. What were some of your favorites? Can we just stop for a second and just talk about this? I love cadence.
Corporate terms.
I love when people say cadence.
Yeah, you know, that comes up a lot with us because we talk about episode count and when it comes out all the time. So we talk about it, or, you know, it feels like a good cadence to have Tuesday and Thursday or whatever.
Oh, and Signal. Signal is a relatively newer one. It's like, we have signaled the blah, blah, blah.
Oh, God. Yeah. I've been using that a lot, too. Ew.
It goes around, man. It goes around. Don't beat yourself up. The one that still mystifies me, though, is somewhere along the line in the past few years, a specific kind of question just became an ask.
That's a big ask.
That's a big ask.
Big ask. Yeah. Jeez. Speaking of, let's get into academia, because my vocabulary certainly stems in the beginning from STEM. No, I'm just showing you.
Hey, there it is.
But from my education. That's where it begins. And it was furthered when I went to college. College is a fantastic thing, in my opinion, and it should be available to every human being on the planet, if, you know, however possible, especially if you live in the United States. It should be paid for by the government, I think. Oh man, hot take, sorry. Don't get mad at me. I think that would be smart if we pooled our money and sent all of our, you know, younger kids to college. I think that would be smart.
I would say, you know, I'm with you there. I would take it a little further. I would say higher education in general is a good thing, because, you know, look, for the past decade or so, more than the past decade, there's been this narrative perpetrated on the American people, which says that one must attend a university, one must attend a college. And that is simply not true. We have a great need for the trades. And that is absolutely higher education. You know what I mean?
I think we're thinking about it incorrectly. I think the trades should be colleges, a part of a college. Like, it should be seen as an equal pursuit. Because if you could become a master of, you can become a master of really anything. And like you said, those trades are highly necessary and needed right now. We just need to think about them as though it is truly higher education and something to be lauded.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agreed. And with that being said, let's visit the Ivory Tower. Let's travel. You know what, Matt? Let's go to Georgetown University specifically.
Ooh, I've heard of that place.
This is one of the country's most well-known, prestigious centers of higher learning. This is a place where if you attend there, you have massive advantages after your education simply because of the name, the networking, the association with this institution.
The family members that probably went there.
Perhaps, yeah, perhaps.
Not probably.
Well, I mean, they're definitely legacy hires, and it's a difficult school to get into. It has very high standards. Not for nothing is it considered a world-class institution. Today, it's known for churning out students, shooting them straight from the lecture hall, boom, to some of the highest positions in the world of nonprofits and Wall Street, private industries, the U.S. government. If it were a business, then we could say that business is booming. And you're right, Matt. Many of these alumni go on to send their kids to Georgetown, or they participate in the feedback loop and they keep the money and the influence spinning in a circular fashion. They donate large amounts of money or they assist with construction for the school. Things are looking pretty great for Georgetown U.
Oh, yeah, they are. I'm just going to put forward here that, you know, all those donations we're talking about probably have a lot to do with why the kids get in. That's my opinion. Anyway, moving on. The thing is, Georgetown University, this thing wasn't always an organization of this high esteem. It was built. It had to be created. It had to do good and have students who were successful to have that reputation, to build that reputation. Here's the deal. The school didn't have a bunch of money, and it didn't have – it was lacking a lot of things, and it almost got shut down in 1838. Like we said, it's been around for a long time. And, you know, let's say you're a university and college. What do you do to get extra funds? Have some kind of fundraiser? You know, call up those alumni and say, hey, I know you're in Congress now. It'd be great to get a little something-something for the university for the generations next. Well, what Georgetown University unfortunately did in 1838 when they were in trouble is they sold human beings to stay afloat.
Yeah. So Georgetown was founded in January of 1789, and the road to success was rocky for the institution. They did participate in the slave trade, and they did it more than once. It wasn't just 1838. We are on such a here's where it gets worse mission today, man. So they had conducted individual slave trade transactions before, and it turns out that more than a dozen universities, including Ivy League players like Harvard and Columbia, have publicly recognized their ties to slavery and to the slave trade. But the 1838 transaction from the people who were running Georgetown, it stands out due to the sheer number of human beings involved.
Ben, did you mention already that the group, the Jesuits, helped out in this pursuit?
Oh, no, yes. Very good point. Speaking of another institution with some skeletons in the closet, yes, the Jesuit order ran Georgetown at the time of this transaction, or this crime, and they were instrumental in the series of events.
And just so you know, we have a whole episode on this group, the Jesuits, called The Jesuits Fact and Fiction. You can find it, I believe, in many places. It came out a long time ago in, 2014. So
what? Wow.
So you may have to wait for the classic to come out if you're an Apple Podcasts only listener, but otherwise you can find it on other podcast outlets like iHeartRadio's app. Okay.
All right.
Didn't mean to derail us there.
No. It was perfect. I am in awe. I think you win this. If I did a 7 on the Segway, you, my friend, just did an 8.5.
Ooh.
On the mentions.
On the call outs of the iHeart app.
On the call outs, yeah. So we are, you know, we do want to be honest with you folks, we're working to inject a little bit of levity in this episode because these are truly, these are unclean things. So here's what happened. In a desperate bid to survive and become the amazing institution it is today, Georgetown sold off 272 people in 1838. They shipped these people to the Deep South. They consigned them to a life of horror on plantations in cotton country. And the thing is, at Georgetown in this time, slavery and scholarship were inextricably linked.
Yeah, it wasn't just selling the slaves. It was then using slaves to make money. And then using that money to make the Institute just function on a regular basis. They relied on these Jesuit plantations, and a lot of them were in Maryland. These things would finance everything, the operations. It's so weird. There were even people at Georgetown who were working with Georgetown who, quote unquote, donated slaves to this pursuit.
Mm-hmm. And this 1838 transaction netted the college more than a little more than $3 million in today's time. So this was massively profitable. You know what you're thinking? The people doing this are members of a spiritual order, one that believes in good and noble things. So surely some priests objected, right? That's correct. Fortunately, yes, some priests did object vocally, vociferously, and they tried their best to prevent the sale of human beings. That sounds good to hear until you understand why they had a problem with it exactly. It's not quite what you think.
Yeah. Please join me in throwing up in your mouth a little bit as we go through this. They weren't objecting to the physical dangers they were putting these people in by, trading them to force them to go and work. They weren't even objecting to the concept of selling human beings at all. What they were worried about was religion. They were worried about the Southern owners of these plantations forcing the slaves, the people that they were selling, to practice Protestantism instead of Catholicism, because that would have been really, really bad.
Yeah, that was the line. You know, one fantastic thing that Georgetown has done, however, is to acknowledge and address this and study this and learn from it. There's an historian at Georgetown named Adam Rothman who noted, quote, "The university itself owes its existence to this history, and Georgetown has been taking steps to evolve." In 2019, just last year, 2 years ago now, the college announced it would launch a new fundraising effort to assist the living descendants of the 272 enslaved people who were sold by the school's founders, which I think is, I think that speaks highly to the institution.
Yeah, no, it really does. Some of it is so counterintuitive when you think about it, because you hear fundraising effort. Oh, they're going to raise other people's money to pay for their thing that they did. Mm-hmm. But, it is a college, and it does cost a lot of money for one of these things to function. So you can't just pull all of the money out unless you're going to risk closing the school down or forcing it to shut down for a bit. But goodness, something like that just gives me mixed feelings, I suppose. But here's the great thing. Georgetown changed its tune, and a lot of this was occurring because of internal pressure from students they are educating, which is actually it's a fantastic sign, right? Mm-hmm. That the organization itself maybe is evolving alongside its students.
Yeah, the students of Georgetown voted Six months before that announcement in 2019, the students at Georgetown voted to institute a $27.20 student fee that would go entirely to supporting the descendants of the victims of this crime. And honestly, it is an amazing step. I know there's no way you can change the past, but this is an important step in the right direction. So we have some light at the end of the tunnel with Georgetown, right? We've explored medicine. We've explored the environment. We've explored academia. Now we're going to pause for word from our sponsor, and we'll return with one more. And it is a doozy.
And we're back. Hey, remember at the top of this episode when I mentioned we were going to talk about population control again? Well, we're here. Let's introduce a little organization called Planned Parenthood.
You know it. You've heard of it. Regardless of your personal values, your personal beliefs, you are familiar in some way with this organization. It was founded by Margaret Sanger, who opened her first birth control clinic in 1916. Then she went on to form the American Birth Control League in 1921. In 1942, the name was changed to Planned Parenthood. Today, the organization is active in some capacity in multiple countries. It operates over 600 health clinics through its affiliate network in the U.S. alone. It's best known, of course, for reproductive health services, for sex ed, sexual education. It is the largest single provider of these services in the U.S., and it also works to prevent the spread of disease. It also offers cancer screenings. It is, for many people, a life-saving institution.
Make no mistake, this organization has done so much good in the world. Mm-hmm. It truly has. And if you cannot acknowledge that or see that, I urge you to re-examine or rethink the good parts, because there truly has been great things that this organization has done.
Pretty cool not to have cancer. That's one.
Well, yeah, and just reproductive health in general for women, and to be able to take control of their lives and their bodies. This institution is instrumental in just empowering women.
Yeah, that's objectively true. But the thing about this life-saving institution is that the founder didn't want to save everybody's life. Sanger wanted to save the right kind of lives, as she saw it, because she was a eugenicist.
Yes. Eugenics was this discipline, I would say, from back in the day, but unfortunately it still exists in 2021. It was championed by a lot of people, prominent people, scientists who existed in the world and who were at the tops of their fields. It is now widely debunked, but it promoted good breeding. This is in quotes, good breeding, and aimed to prevent poor breeding. Now, good and poor breeding, that sounds a little subjective. That's because it is.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not a good scientific basis for eugenics as described, desired, and practiced by people in Sanger's time. Sanger, the basic idea is that the overall human species can be improved through encouraging reproduction in people with traits like, well, to their mind, it was stuff like intelligence, hard work, and cleanliness. We don't have a full scientific understanding of intelligence, and hard work and cleanliness are pretty much opinions. Pretty much opinions. So the most terrifying example of eugenics motivated crimes are acts of genocide. That is one ultimate destination for that line of thinking. Sanger thought that poverty and what she described as unwantedness were the main reasons children might grow up to be, in some way, to her opinion, morally or physically defective. And so Sanger came up with a solution.
There was an idea where if someone exhibited birth defects of one kind or another, Sanger would advocate that they be sent away, literally sent away, to a farm somewhere very, very far away and segregated from the rest of the population to make sure that they are unable to even physically have relations with someone and therefore children. And if they were going to mingle within all the other people in society, they would need to be sterilized.
Right. Yeah. So what is a defect to Sanger? A defect, it could be anything. A physical deformity, even if it's one that is not genetically reproducible, right? A physical deformity or a perceived lack of moral fiber, whatever the hell that is. So there was huge potential for people to be carted off just because their behavior did not fit into social norms of the time. This bit of history had a dubious moment in the spotlight when the politician Ben Carson claimed that Sanger was racist in part of a larger attack on Planned Parenthood to support Carson's aim of making abortion illegal in the United States. So if you check with primary sources, by which we mean things written by Sanger herself about her views, her attitudes on race are doubtlessly problematic and paternalistic today, but at the time they might have been seen as somewhat progressive. For example, in 1946, she wrote that all women, regardless of their ostensible race, should have a voice in how many children they have. I feel like that's a very reasonable thing, right? Like if you're listening and you have or you plan to have children, then doesn't it feel like the number of children you have should be kind of up to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. We're mentioning some things that Margaret Sanger said. There are lots of places you can go online to do further research. I would recommend an opinion piece from USA Today. It is called Remove Statuses of Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood Founder Tied to Eugenics and Racism. Again, this is an opinion piece on USA Today. So keep that in mind if you do choose to read it. What I would recommend is look at the supporting links that are in the article, because that is the kind of thing that Ben is referring to here. These are actual words that you can find that were spoken by Margaret Sanger.
Yeah. And with this, we're drawing our episode to a close. We have just scratched the tip of the iceberg here. And again, there's a dilemma. The conundrum is the following. The institutions, every institution that we have mentioned in today's show has inarguably, objectively done awesome, amazing things for the world and the people within it today. And we cannot discount this work, this tremendously good work for the world, but we also cannot be blind to the origins of some of these movements. And we know that there are many, many more out there. We would like to hear from you. In our examples today, the institutions have all made or attempted to make amends for their past. But what other stories are out there? What are some more strange, disturbing origin stories that you're aware of? What would you like to share with our fellow listeners? Let us know. You can find us on the internet. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. We like to recommend Here's Where It Gets Crazy, where you can hang out, see some very weird stuff, see some news. It's been rated the best page on the internet 5 times in a row by us arbitrarily at the end of some of our shows.
Yeah, definitely not Forbes magazine. They had nothing to do with it. Before you do that, I want to recommend one more piece to read. Just, I'm so sorry, we didn't get to spend a lot of time on Margaret Sanger. I want to recommend a piece from The Atlantic called Abortion's Racial Gap. This is another just important piece of information that you could add into the puzzle that is your mind when thinking about all of this stuff. It's worth it. Check it out. If you don't want to find us on social media because that's not your thing, you can always give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave a message. It may go into one of our listener mail episodes. Please let us know what you'd like to be called, as well as if you give us permission to use your voice on the show. That would be fantastic. And do know and be aware, if you call in, the number from which you call gets logged. So I can see it. Ben can see it. We can see the number that you call in from. If you wish to obfuscate that, you can, you know, use a different number, like a Google Voice number or something like that. Otherwise, you might get a call back on your cell from me. So good luck to you.
Somewhat ominous there, man.
Well, if you get a call from me, it's like it's game over, man. We're going to talk.
if you don't care for social media, if you don't care for telephones, but you have a story you need to share, or even better, a suggestion for a topic we can cover in the future, there's always one other way to contact us. It is our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.